Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. I am filling in tonight for my friend and colleague, George Norrie, who I am told has to be practically forced to take time off, and I can relate to that. We have one heck of a lineup for you tonight, jam-packed with explorations of the strange and wonderful phantasmagorical swirl of weirdness that at times is all around us. Coming up in just a few minutes, prolific author, adventurer David Hatcher Childress. If you watch any of the shows on the History Channel about ancient mysteries, lost civilizations, even ancient aliens, you've probably seen his interviews. He's sort of a real-life Indiana Jones, has traveled all over the world chasing down fantastic stories, legends, and lore, and has published a couple of dozen books on a wide range of subjects that are staples here on Coast to Coast AM. Really looking forward to speaking with him about some of the mysteries that have roots right here in the Southwest, including persistent tales about ancient Egyptians scurrying around the Grand Canyon centuries before Europeans arrived in the New World. And then in hour two, a chilling real-life tale of a family's ordeal that began as an encounter with the unknown. This is not your typical friendly space brethren, E.T. here to eat your Reese's Pieces or phone home kind of story. This is spooky stuff. A little known but well-documented story of an out-and-out fight between humans and non-humans. It's the subject of a new book by MUFON investigators Ruben Uriarte and Noe Torres called Aliens in the Forest. We'll have audio clips also from the central witness in this strange episode, a story that could not be told in its entirety for decades. Tonight, the whole thing comes spilling out. Webmaster Lex and I have compiled our usual smattering of oddities for our Naps News section on the Coast website. Among the items there tonight, a newspaper article about the Grand Canyon that is an appropriate lead-in to our interview with David Childress. Also there, a UFO video you may not have seen that was analyzed by, among others, the special effects wizards who work for George Lucas. A weird coincidence involving a piece of space debris and where it crashed in Russia, and some encouraging medical news about a pill that could boost your memory and fight off Alzheimer's, plus a few other tidbits. Check them out when you get a moment. We have a lot of ground to cover tonight, so let's get right to it. We'll take our first break, come right back with my guest, author, investigator, David Hatcher Childress. I'm George Knapp, in tonight for George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. I'm George Knapp, in tonight for George Norrie. David Hatcher Childress left the United States back in 1976 on the start of a grand adventure that has stretched over a couple of decades. He wanted to study firsthand ancient civilizations in Africa, the Middle East, and China. He's journeyed into some pretty dangerous territory along the way, has widened his scope of interests, is sort of a recognized expert on ancient civilizations and technology, also on topics near and dear to our hearts, free energy, anti-gravity, and UFOs. He is, I think, it's no exaggeration to say, sort of a real-life Indiana Jones, and I'm thrilled to have him here. David, great to have you on the program.
Hi, George. It's great to be on your show.
I have to wonder, after I see you as often as I do on television, do you own a piece of the History Channel, or is that just a coincidence?
Well, that would be handy if I did. And in fact, I just came back from Mexico, and a few weeks before that in Peru and Bolivia, doing new episodes for the History Channel show Ancient Aliens. Yeah.
Man, you got a cool job. You really do.
It is a great job, and that show has been very popular for History Channel, and I'm thrilled, of course. And it's now going into a fourth season, which is great.
It occurs to me as I watch you on television, the things you say and the places you go, that you must drive mainstream archaeologists crazy. The amount of attention that you get, I can just hear them gnashing their teeth and screaming about it. Who is this guy? How does he get away with saying this outrageous stuff?
People in Peru and Bolivia, some friends of mine who also watch the shows and were telling me exactly the same thing. They said, oh, they hate you, David, you're on the show. One of the things that will be in the next upcoming episodes, George, is some interesting stuff about the El Fuente Magna Bowl and a statue that's now in the Gold Museum in La Paz, Bolivia. And these two artifacts, one is a ceramic bowl, the other is a granite statue, and they have Sumerian writing on them. And that will be in an upcoming episode of Ancient Aliens. And that's exactly the kind of thing that mainstream archaeology hates to have happen. And in fact, they brought out the statue, the Pocatilla statue, which is found in this lost pyramid there near Tiwanaku. And it'll never have been on TV before until this episode of Ancient Aliens. It will probably be shown in February or March.
You know, for you to say, aha, this has Sumerian writing, I can see them saying, well, what does this guy know about Sumerian writing? You know, I've seen the online criticism that, look, you don't have a PhD, you're not a professional archaeologist, and yet it seems to me that with your background, as much traveling as you've done, hands-on, boots-on-the-ground kind of research, you probably have the equivalent of 3 or 4 PhDs. Talk a little bit about your background, how you got into this, how you've been able to keep it going.
Well, and I'm not a Sumerian scholar either, so it's not like, although we can get into that more later, how would they know this is Sumerian writing. But I started out in the mid-70s as I was an English teacher in Taiwan. I had been studying Mandarin at the University of Montana. I was one of the early $5-a-day backpackers around the world. Early on, I wanted to go to Mount Everest, and I was always interested in Tibet and India, and basically that's what I got to do. Although if I had $500 on me, you know, I was rich in those days, and I went on to Israel and ultimately Egypt and Sudan. I ultimately traveled through Africa for a couple of years and worked for Chevron Oil, actually, in Sudan, looted Idi Amin's house during the war back in 79. So I'm glad to be alive, but ultimately I returned to India after hitchhiking on yachts through the Indian Ocean and the Seychelles and Mauritius. And then the last few years of my big travels, which was set in the early 80s, was going to Central America and South America. And I spent several years traveling around there and then ultimately to Pacific Islands, to remote islands and whatnot. And that was ultimately all those travels, which was 7 or 8 years, ended up in my Lost Cities series, which is like 6 books of in that series, which are regional, and including the last one, which is about the Southwest and the Egyptian caverns in the Grand Canyon and other mysteries of the Southwest.
So. And we'll jump into that. I want you to address, though, before we get into specifics, sort of the attitude of mainstream archaeology and history. I respect people in those professions. I respect the work that they've done. But am I characterizing this correct to say that they're a little bit stodgy and they really don't like somebody like you coming along and upsetting the apple cart to challenge established principles and ideas that have been in textbooks and have been taught in college courses for so many decades?
Well, right. And you know, one of the early archaeologists and one of my heroes who was a thorn in the side of the mainstream was the famous Norwegian archaeologist Thor Heyerdahl. And I was fortunate to meet him one time in northern Peru at the pyramids there at Sipan. What a great guy. And part of it with mainstream archaeology is what they call isolationism. And we're basically taught in universities here in the United States and generally all over the world that ancient civilizations were isolated from each other. They didn't have much contact. People didn't travel across oceans. Oceans are barriers rather than highways. People can't just get into some boat and cross the ocean and go to remote islands or cross the Atlantic or the Pacific. They have to walk everywhere that they go. And then, of course, everybody in South America somehow walked from Siberia all the way down through thousands of miles of hostile tribes. But Thor Heyerdahl and myself in my books and other archaeologists, fortunately, our whole thing is that oceans aren't barriers, they're highways. And that's the easy way to travel around the world and to go places. And ancient people did exactly that. They traveled and went places in boats. And in my books, like Technology of the Gods and stuff, I say they even had flight and flew in Vimanas and stuff, just like we do today.
Is the burden of proof greater for somebody like you who's challenging the established ideas? Do you have to go way above and beyond to sort of shed new light and get people to change their minds? I know that they do change their minds. You see it in the history of humans in North America. It used to be we figured there was basically nothing here until fairly recently, and now the more we know, the more we realize there were all kinds of people here longer and longer ago in history than anyone could possibly imagine. I mean, they've grudgingly accepted that, right? But in general, it must be pretty tough for you to convince folks like that that they've been wrong.
Well, exactly. And particularly how old civilization is and how old and how long mankind has been, say, in the Americas. Mainstream archaeology is fortunately pushing this back farther and farther. We have the Göbekli Tepe ruins now in Turkey that are megalithic. Mainstream archaeology has to admit, yeah, these things are like 10,000 years old. Now we're talking about the time of Atlantis and stuff like that. The idea that people have been in North America and then South America for 20,000, 30,000, 50,000 years, that mainstream archaeologists have not accepted that. They still don't. But they are pushing it back. And all the time, what they call the Clovis barrier of how long ancient people have been here, typically that was 12,000 years ago. Now they're saying, okay, 15. But the idea that mankind has been in North and South America for well over 20, 50,000 years, and how old civilization is. How old have people been around, just like us, building pyramids, building roads, building bridges, building ports, getting into big boats, traveling across the ocean, mining and stuff like that. And in a way, it's unscientific to say that people couldn't get into boats or travel or do much of what we do today. I mean, and that's something goes beyond all just going into boats and stuff. The idea that ancient people had electricity, that they could make machines, make computers, in the sense of even high-tech computers today with crystals and things, but even just really complicated machines like the Antikythera device with lots of cogs and wheels and hard pieces of metal. And, of course, when you read, like, the ancient Indian epics, the Ramayana, part of the Mahabharata and whatnot, they're talking about these guys having airships. They call them Vimanas. Every Hindu, every Buddhist knows those stories. Rama gets in his airship. These are actual machines. They fly around just like we do today. They have horrific weapons. They fight aerial battles. They land. They have airports and all that kind of stuff. That's what those ancient books say, and you know, I write about it in my books, and it's not like everything that is a legend or a myth is actually true, but in my mind, there's some truth to it. And I was trying to figure out the fact from fiction and the truth in these legends that's really fascinating and that drives me around the world to see all these places for myself and try and figure out what's going on.
We run into it a lot on the subjects we cover on this program. George Norrie and Ian and myself and the other hosts as well, the resistance from mainstream whatever, mainstream scientists dealing with UFOs, for example, mainstream historians dealing with alternative versions of human history. And it you're right, it does seem anti-scientific. What it seems like is religion, that they hang on to beliefs with the fervor of a religious fanatic, as opposed to an open-minded scientist who's interested in learning the truth.
It totally agree with you there. It's like science has become the new religion and a dogmatic one at that. Really, to if you just look at history, people just like us. In fact, ancient people were taller than us. They had bigger brains. And that people would just, it's us, in fact, we would just sit in our caves for 100,000 years, and then suddenly just 7,000 years ago or something, we suddenly decided, oh, let's get out of these caves. Let's start making stuff. Let's build some pyramids and some bridges and some boats, and let's go somewhere. But it seems like all that happened 100,000 years ago, and even more, maybe.
The excuse I used to get you on the program, and I wanted to do it for a long time, was an article I read in an Arizona newspaper back in November dealing with the Grand Canyon. And it references you at the end of the article. And then I found, quite by accident, in a bookstore in a tiny little town in central Nevada, Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest, what I guess your most recent book, and started digging into that because of so much of it touches on things that are of interest to people who live here. Let's talk about the Grand Canyon story for a couple of minutes. The idea that ancient Egyptians could have been in there, what is the evidence? How strong is the case? Talk about it for a couple of minutes.
You bet. It's a very strong case. And the more you look into it, the stronger it gets and the more interesting. It all started with a Phoenix Gazette story on April 5th in 1909. It was this highly detailed story, and I actually show you the news clippings in my book, and then other photos too, Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest. And in that story, it talks about the Smithsonian doing excavations of these unusual caverns, a labyrinth of tunnels going back into the Grand Canyon. A guy named Jordan, who's from the Smithsonian, is named. It's quite a detailed account. It's in the Phoenix Gazette in 1909. It starts with an explorer who's going down the Grand Canyon. He sees up on the walls of this one part, and it's exactly where this is it's still a controversy. We think it's near to where the Little Colorado River meets the main Colorado River in the Grand Canyon, and that's two giant gorges and canyons meeting each other. This one prospector had seen, as he was going through the canyon, what looked like a mine opening and tailings coming out of this opening. He went up inside it. What he found in there were, he said, statues, swords, Egyptian artifacts, gold plates, other hieroglyphic things. Some of it apparently looked like it was Tibetan or Buddhist. Other stuff he thought was Egyptian. He was amazed at what was there. He went to Phoenix. He contacted the Smithsonian. They sent out this archaeologist. They were doing all the excavations. The Phoenix Gazette found out the whole story, published it. They published a lot of other kind of similar stories around the superstitions and things of caverns and unusual caves and things, other artifacts. And in fact, the more I looked into it, it seemed very much like the end of the Indiana Jones movie of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And they found the Ark, the story's over. Indiana Jones then says to his bosses, he says, well, where's the Ark now? What have you done with it? And they tell him, oh, don't worry, you know, top men are working on it. They'll take it from here. And that's basically the end of the movie. And the last scene is then you're seeing the Ark of the Covenant, this important artifact, being put into this giant warehouse, which is the Smithsonian, of crates and whatnot, and it's not going to be ever seen again. And that's the end of the movie. And for years I kept thinking, well, why would they cover up something like this? Are there really archaeological cover-ups? Important discoveries are made, but then the powers that be decide, oh, no, we can't let everyone know this. And that's what's happening in the Indiana Jones movie. And ultimately, I came to the conclusion, particularly with this Egyptians in the Grand Canyon, that something exactly like that was occurring and that there was this cover-up was going on and that the Smithsonian was involved. Now, it's not necessary that people today at the Smithsonian would really know about this, and they're not part of this cover-up, but something like this could have happened back then, and the idea that there are artifacts still at the Smithsonian, is an interesting idea that could be coming from this. And I found out other things, too, I mean, that we can go into perhaps, in a little bit.
Okay, I think we're coming up on a break here. I do know that the National Park Service, not surprisingly, refers to this story as poppycock, but we'll give you a chance to address their attitude. And a group known the Pistol Annies, hot new album, sort of a song for our times, if you've heard this stuff, taking us into the break. I'm George Knapp in for George Norrie here on Coast to Coast AM. I want to use this moment before we resume our interview with David Hatcher-Childress to mention the Coast Insiders Club. It's previously known as our Streamlink service. If you're like me, you find it hard to listen to Coast every night, especially if you got to go to work in the morning. You can't stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning. For less than 25 cents a day, you can sign up for this service. You can listen to the program whenever it's convenient for you, on your phone, on your MP3 player, whatever works for you. It's the ultimate in convenience. Plus, you get a backlog of about 1,000 programs in our archives to listen to at your convenience. It's a pretty good deal if you want to check it out. We'll resume our interview to talk about the possibility of ancient Egyptians running around in the Grand Canyon with David Hatcher-Childress right after this on Coast to Coast AM. David Hatcher-Childress is a prolific writer. His most recent book, Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest, but he's got a couple of other ones in the works, and we'll talk to him about those. Let's get back to discussing the Grand Canyon. Is there physical evidence that suggests that Egyptians or something, a civilization like that, an ancient civilization, was in the Grand Canyon?
Well, I try to present as much of that in my book as I can. In my researches, what I found out was that there are some unusual things in the Grand Canyon, including what is called the Sipapu, the Hopi Indians, and in fact the Zunis as well, claim that during the destruction of the four worlds, like the Mayans and Aztecs talked about, that at one point the Hopis and the Zunis say they lived underground inside the Grand Canyon, and they lived with the ant people, and that they emerged from this underground world of the Grand Canyon from a place called the Sipapu, and that's a real place within the Grand Canyon. It's you can't go there, and that's another thing about the Grand Canyon, that it's highly controlled. It's a huge area, and in fact, I live near the Grand Canyon. I'm coming to you from near Sedona, Arizona, in northern Arizona. And so the idea that there's these places that's highly controlled, you cannot just go wandering around the Grand Canyon looking for these caves or Egyptian catacombs or whatever, believe me, you'll be stopped instantly by these rangers and whatnot. Now, they don't necessarily know what's down there. These things long ago were closed up. They've put giant cage doors around it. There's areas of the Grand Canyon that I found out that you cannot go into. Even rangers aren't allowed to go into certain areas. Also, there are whole areas of the Grand Canyon that are named after all these Egyptian names, Cheops Pyramid, Temple of Isis, Temple of Set. So for whatever reason, early explorers did name many of the sites and stuff in the Grand Canyon after Egyptian names. Another curious story that I found out is a story of an early Mormon trader whose name was Seth Tanner. Seth Tanner, a lot of Mormons had come down into this area of northern Arizona and northeast Arizona. Including this guy, Seth Tanner, another guy named Lee, who runs Lee's Ferry. And in fact, Seth Tanner put his name on many of the things around the Grand Canyon. One of the most famous trails going down to the Grand Canyon, right near the area where the Little Colorado meets the main Colorado River, is called Tanner Trail. Now, something happened to this guy, Seth Tanner. He was married to a couple of Indian gals, a Hopi, also a Navajo. But he saw something in the Grand Canyon, some forbidden place that the Hopis, and the Hopis also have this special salt mine that's in the Grand Canyon, and you can't go there either. And that is also in this area of the Little Colorado. This is the area of Cameron going to to Tanner Point and whatnot in the Grand Canyon. Well, Seth Tanner, somehow exploring around, this is all right around 1890, and what he entered some kind of cave system in the Grand Canyon, which apparently is the same catacombs of the Egyptians that were the Egyptian catacombs that were talked about in the Phoenix Gazette article in 1909. And what he saw, the Hopis were going to kill him. But because he was married to a Hopi woman, they decided they would only blind him. And they threw this acid in his eyes. And there's a famous photograph of him as this blind old man. And I have it in my book. And they blinded him because he had seen these secret caverns in the Grand Canyon. And we don't know what they were. But he was a totally real person. And in fact, just in the last year, I was in Gallup, New Mexico, which is famous for its trading posts and whatnot. And one of the trading posts there is the Elias Tanner Trading Post. And they are the descendants of this guy, Seth Tanner. I talked to them. I gave them copies of my book. We talked about him. They were thrilled that that some of his history was in my book. And, of course, they were familiar with the stories of him being blinded and whatnot. And it somehow has to do with these so-called Egyptian caverns in the Grand Canyon. Then I was sent an old stereograph, one of these early 3D postcard sets, and where you have two photos. And this was also from the turn of the century, and it was of the Grand Canyon. And it was an unusual photo because what it showed, and I put these photos in my book too, it shows what looks like this sphinx, an Egyptian sphinx with a face and everything. And in fact, it looks kind of like the face on Mars. And it's a stereo photo. I couldn't put it in stereo there, but I have it in the book, and you can see it, this sphinx that was carved there. But where this is in the Grand Canyon, I can't find it.
Yeah, it's a remarkable similarity. I saw the photo in the book. It seemed to me I read in the newspaper article about some figurines that were found and were carbon dated. They go way, way back. Do you know much about those?
You know, that article that you were talking about, I haven't seen, and I would like to see it. There are places in the Grand Canyon, like the Unkar Delta, where they know that there were cities, that there are archaeological excavations have been done there. They go back thousands of years. Also in the book, I talk about some unusual discoveries made at Aztec, New Mexico, and the salmon ruins there, or some really strange things were discovered there, including these tablets. And these tablets had writing on them and pictures of elephants. And I've got those in the book, too. And it seems to show the idea that ancient Chinese, Hindus, Egyptians, what they call the Cam people from Vietnam. The Olmecs are like this. That's one of the mysteries of the Olmecs, and that's one of my other books from a few years ago called The Mystery of the Olmecs. How the Olmecs themselves have these 20-ton colossal heads. Many of them look like they're Africans. Others look like they're Chinese. Others look very Mediterranean with big beards and thick mustaches. American Indians don't have mustaches or beards. And so here you have the Olmecs and then other what seems to be evidence of Chinese and Egyptians and stuff coming to America. And when it adds all up and I put it all together, it makes the story of the Egyptians in Grand Canyon from the Phoenix Gazette article in 1909 make more sense. And it all becomes quite believable to me. Plus the idea that people were traveling around the world, they would travel in big ships. The Chinese, the Hindus, the Egyptians, they had giant ships, much bigger ships than Columbus and Vikings and people like that had. So the idea that they were coming here, I mean, makes a lot of sense. But what did they do when they were here? And the idea that they were going to the Grand Canyon, even that the Hopi Indians and Zuni Indians are somehow even descendants of these same people. And that's their own legends basically are saying something like that.
The article I'm referring to is on our website. When we next go to the break, you can check it out. But one of the points it makes is that these figurines were found in a limestone cavern in 1963. They were carbon dated back to 2145 BC. So that's 3,600 years before Columbus, you know, reportedly discovered America. I don't know if that's older than the known Hopi or Anasazi or any of their ancestors, or whether it just could be them, or it indicates it's somebody that we didn't know was here that early.
Do the figurines look like they're Chinese or something like that?
Yeah, I don't have that information. I'm just it was included in this article about the all things Egyptian as it related to the canyon. Let me ask you this: mummies. You know, a lot of mummies have been found throughout the Western U.S. We've got one that was found in Nevada some years ago called Spirit Caveman. I did some stories on it years ago. I think it's more than 11,000 years old, which sort of really throws a lot of estimates about when humans were first here out the window. What can you tell me about mummies in general? Do we have anything that looks like Egyptian mummies found here in the Southwest? Anything truly unusual that fits into sort of this?
That's a pretty good question, because that's exactly what was also supposedly discovered at these caverns in the Grand Canyon were a bunch of mummies. But it's been generally said that, oh, you know, the ancient Americans, the Native Americans, oh, they didn't mummify the dead. They didn't create graveyards. That's one of the big mysteries of Chaco Canyon in northwest New Mexico, is that here's this giant ancient city. It was abandoned. But they can't find any graveyards there. They can't find any dead people or anything, and they can't figure out what happened to them. But they have found mummies. And a mummy was found at Mesa Verde. There's been other mummies found supposedly around the Grand Canyon. If you go into southern Arizona, as you're headed for El Paso from Tombstone and Benson and Tucson, you start seeing the archetypical billboards for the desert roadside attraction, and it starts saying The Thing. It's 100 miles to The Thing. What is The Thing? Eventually, you're driving to the desert. You come to this gas station. And it's right by the interstate now, and it's The Thing. And then you go and you pay a dollar. You get to go in and see what The Thing is, and what The Thing is a mummy. It's a woman and a child. And it's a mummy. And then talking to the people there, they said, oh, yeah, supposedly this came from Flagstaff, Arizona. And I said, really, Flagstaff? And they said, yeah, that's the story, supposedly, with this. Well, Flagstaff is right near the Grand Canyon. So what I surmised in the end, and I've got pictures of this, of course, in the book as well, is that, yeah, this is a mummy coming from those caves. There was a great movie made in the 1960s with Gregory Peck and Omar Sharif called McKenna's Gold.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if that's a great movie or not. It certainly was a big budget movie, but it kind of bombed, didn't it?
I think it was a bomb at the time. I was a kid in Durango, Colorado watching it. But that movie is all a thinly veiled story of the Grand Canyon episode before it really got out. I mean, a few people knew about the article in the Phoenix Gazette, but they basically go to this lost city. This guy Seth Tanner is also in the movie where he's blinded.
He's
one of the characters. You should watch that again.
Yeah,
Edgar G. Robinson, in fact, plays Seth Tanner basically in the movie, although they call him Adams, and that's another story of lost treasure called the Adams Gold. But that character is very much, obviously, Seth Tanner, the blind old man.
Let me expand this for a moment.
Beard and everything.
Yeah, let me expand this for a moment to something else that I think that you've encountered all over the world, and that's stories about giants. Sometimes there are mummies to back up the stories of giants. I know those stories are fairly persistent in the Southwest about races of giants. How prevalent are those stories? How often do you hear them? How widespread are they? And what do you think these giants were? Are they from somewhere else? Are they humans? Did they die out? What's the deal?
Well, also in the book, yeah, I have several chapters where I talk about the giants. And a lot of that happened, as you probably know, George, in Nevada, around Death Valley, Southern California. A number of giant skeletons were allegedly discovered in around the Nevada-California border. There's one good photo, and we have it in the book, that has been preserved. These guys were like 7, 8 foot tall. Again, they were mummies and whatnot. there's the same story along those lines that I've investigated, although it's that story is in my book, Lost Cities of North and Central America. And the Ancient Aliens did an episode on it, too, and flew me out to Reno, and that's the Lovelock Caves. That today is a national park in Nevada, the Lovelock Caves. There's two museums in Nevada dedicated to the Lovelock Caves, one in Lovelock, one in Winnemucca. And what basically happened there was the Paiute Indians had these stories of these giants, red-haired giants, who were 7-8 foot tall. They lived around this lake. They were stealing the Paiute women. The Paiutes eventually drove them into this cave where they lit a big bonfire, killed them all. This was their big story. And that was how the Paiutes got rid of the giants. Well, then, right around 1900, same time as around Seth Tanner and whatnot, these ranchers began digging out bat guano out of the Lovelock Cave. It had 20 feet of bat guano in it. But as they began digging out the guano, they started finding artifacts, duck decoys, baskets for fishing and duck hunting in these lakes that are now gone from Nevada. If you go to Lovelock area today, there used to be this giant lake there. It's gone. And eventually, the cowboys there, these ranchers, discovered like a dozen red-haired mummies. These guys were 7 feet tall. They pulled them out of the cave. I was told by one of the ladies at the Winnemucca Museum, she said, oh, yeah, we all remember this photo of one of the ranchers, and he's standing on a big crate, and he's holding this red-haired mummy. It's a black-and-white photo, and he's holding it in his hand so that he can hold it up. He has to stand on a crate. It's so tall. And she said, oh, yeah, we all remember that photo. Well, that photo is completely missing, and so are all these giants. And, in fact, the University of California at Berkeley was in charge of all the excavations, and they took these artifacts. Now they're in these two museums in Winnemucca and Lovelock, yet those mummies of these giants and that photo have completely vanished. And there's two museums in Nevada that would love to have just that photo even, much less one of these giant mummies. They've all disappeared.
Do you have stories of giants in Central America, South America, China, the same kind of stories around the world?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, okay, right. There are stories like that all around the world. Part of the thing, and in fact, with these mummies you're talking about being 11,000 years old, there's a museum in Arica in Chile, and the mummies there are also 11,000 years old, they claim. And that's part of the thing, too, is how do you preserve these things? Much of the soil in areas of the world, and this problem in Central America with the Olmecs, who are also supposedly giants and whatnot, is that the soil is very acidic. So, and it's wet down there. Skeletal material of mummies, they don't last for very long, not for thousands of years. But in these really dry areas, like Nevada, Southern California, the deserts of Peru and Chile and whatnot, they can find these mummies and whatnot like that, and they're actually well preserved. And in some cases, they're preserved for 7, 8, 9, 10,000 years, what you're talking about. So.
And so were these giants, were they people or were they from somewhere else? What's your theory?
All right. Well, my new book that I'm coming out with, which is I'm co-authoring with a guy named Brian Forster, who's a Canadian living in Peru, is called The Enigma of Cranial Deformation. And it's all about these cone heads, people with these elongated heads. Many of them were giants, and they were all over the world. This is another thing that has to do with people traveling all over the world, where we're talking about diffusionism, remote Pacific islands, and Egypt, and South America. And one of the things with these guys, these cone heads with these elongated crania, is that in some cases, their skulls were double the size of a normal person. And so this would add, in some cases, 6 to 10 inches in the height of even just a normal person. So you have people who were very much 7-8 feet tall, and in many cases with these elongated heads as well. So where they look like extraterrestrials, in fact. If you were to see one of these guys, and in the book that's coming out in January.
David, I really apologize for not having more time for you. We're going to have you back on. I'd like to do a show just on the Gemstone Files. It's been a pleasure, and I really do hope we can get you back on soon. Thanks very much to David Hatcher Childress. Coming up, Aliens in the Forest, the spookiest ET story you have never heard. I'm George Knapp, in tonight for George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.